Hi, and welcome to A Time to Thrill. It's me, your host, Amy Austin. This month, I have the joy of speaking with DJ Adams. I feel like DJ is one of those people who has many jobs, as we will discuss during the podcast. Okay, so obviously I met her as an author. She published romantic suspense for Carina Press, which at the time was, oh my God, like 15 years ago, was a new Harlequin ebook only imprint, which changed a little bit later. Some authors got print through Harlequin, some did not. That's a whole other conversation, because it was during that era where ebooks took off. Let's see. And I have so many thoughts and feelings about Carina Press, but we'll not get into that. So DJ also, in addition, is an actor. She's done voiceover work. I think she's done her own audiobooks. We will find out. And is a dialogue and acting coach for television. So I met her maybe, oh my God, my child's 14, maybe 15 years ago, a little bit earlier than that, in the Los Angeles Romance Writers Group. Back then, during the day, we used to get together at Borders, which is no longer in business, and talk about writing, selling, our writing successes, and the business of being an author. Also, this is so odd, she and I shared a P.O. box for probably 10 years. At some point, I got a P.O. box so that I could get mail without it coming to my house and business stuff without it coming to my house. And given the exorbitant cost of P.O. boxes in L.A., we shared one. I think you could have up to 5 business names or something on it. And so that's what we did. So I've been to her house picking up mail randomly, and I think the same can be said of her. She's actually the first person I knew who had a Ring doorbell. Okay, this is so random. None of that's important. I think the reason I wanted to talk to DJ, I'm writing a new book, and I was thinking about, I'm writing a new book that actually takes place in LA, and I haven't done that in quite a while. All of the romances I wrote is Julianne Moore. Most of them, I think, take place in Los Angeles. I think 2 don't. Maybe 4 don't. I'm sorry, I'm thinking about it off the top of my head. But I did write about Los Angeles contemporaneously. But all of the Casey Court and Nicole Long books primarily take place in Cleveland, Ohio, and in the past, since I'm writing this linear time that started in the 90s. And I think in the book, I'm maybe up to 2010. So this is the first time in a long time I have written about the present. So I have to shift my focus like 15 years ahead, which is, you know, the present, to write a book that takes place where I am now. And it's sort of interesting because I really think about Los Angeles as taking place in the past. I think of everything taking place in the past. And I don't often write about the present. Oh my God, I just meandered off. And I don't even know how I started talking about this. Okay, I got it. So I was writing, and I was thinking one of the characters in my new book, since she lives in LA, is in the entertainment business. And I was thinking about all the jobs in the entertainment business of people I know and going through like different iterations so I could write this book realistically. And DJ popped into my mind because she has been in this business, we'll talk about it, oh my God, since the 80s, 90s, oh, long time. And she's one of those people who's like a touchstone of what's currently going on in the business. She'll talk about it. She works on the TV show The Conners, and it's the job she has now. But her first job was actually working on Roseanne, which was the other iteration of this show. And it's sort of fascinating to have come full circle, but she's had like, so it's just some of the most interesting stories about working on sets, and maybe we'll discuss some of those. She talks about working on kid shows, which is a whole thing now, especially with the documentaries. But at the time, you know, she worked, I think, at Sunset Gower, and that's where they filmed, oh my God, like those morning kid sitcoms, but before like Disney sort of took off and before Universal took off, there were like a lot of Nickelodeon shows over there. Teenagers, laugh tracks, that kind of thing. And she has some funny stories from that, and actually wrote a book called Overheard on the Set, which we'll talk about, which sort of like encapsulates all the sort of crazy wackadoodle things people say in creative business, where people, I think, feel free to speak in a way that you wouldn't in like an office for like an insurance company or a bank or like a law firm or something like that. So I always find that interesting. So I was writing and I thought about her and I was like, oh my God, I gotta talk to DJ. And as always, I dialed her up and she agreed.
So to update you, I will say that the book, Her Last Mistress, the one that's coming out in January 2025, is done, 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 done. We're through the two editors. It will be ready, like done, done, in about a week, and then we'll get some advanced review copies out and about in the world. And I do want to thank all of you who volunteered to beta read the book. This summer, I found it immensely helpful. It helped me sort of figure out exactly the story I wanted to tell. And I thank you so much and remain grateful. So the book comes out in January 2025. If you haven't pre-ordered it, please do. I'm really excited about the book being able to combine sort of three elements. One, psychological, and social thriller, the same thing I've written about before, a little bit more psychological this time, but also has the point of view of both Nicole Long and Casey Court. So I, for once, not for once, I guess this has happened before, but I'm able to sort of give both their perspectives after having practiced in Cleveland at this point in their careers for 14, 15 years. They've been around the block and they all want the same thing, which is either bad people to stop doing what they're doing or bad people to be punished. And hopefully that everybody is satisfied at the end of this book. I certainly am. And I can't wait to share it with you, so pre-order now. I do want to flag that there were some issues with audio in the beginning because of DJ's internet connectivity, but it smooths out in the end. So without further ado, let's hear from DJ Adams. Hi, and welcome to A Time to Thrill. It's me, your host, Amy Austin. This month, I am interviewing DJ Adams. Hi, DJ.
Hello, how are you?
I am great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Happy to
So,
be here.
I know it's so great to talk to you. So the reason I want to do this interview is because I have a lot of questions because in my head, you're like a Renaissance woman. So many people I know in LA or in New York, for example, have a lot of artistic talents and a lot of things they do. They just don't do them all. honestly. So you tend to do more than most people. So I mean, most people I know, let's say they paint or whatever, but then they do like photography on the side or they write or whatever. But they only have the one main thing that sort of goes out into the world. You have many main things that go out into the world, and I sort of wanted to talk about that because I think a career in the arts is always fascinating. I think a career like integrating many different disciplines. I mean, I'm not saying they're just like way different, but many different disciplines, I think, is also fascinating.
It's fun.
Well, that's the best part. I mean, you get to do the fun thing. So I guess my first question is, where did you grow up?
I grew up in El Paso, Texas,
Okay, that's how
the
did you
desert. And I visited California the first time when I was 8 years old, and I knew then that I was going to move here as soon as I could. And 10 years later, after I graduated, I did. I moved out here, and I've been here ever since. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. That was my escape route. And so, yeah, so I went to school to be an actor. And after a year, I thought I would just try the real world. The school didn't like you, didn't want you to audition for anything while you were in school.
Okay.
So,
And how was it a conservatory? Like, was it 3 years, or what was their expectation that you would not audition while you were in school? I mean, how long was
I,
the time?
well, so yeah, so it was a 3-year program. And I didn't like that I couldn't audition for things that I wanted to get out there. I thought, oh, I'm young. I need to do this now while while it still looks good in the mirror.
So
So,
wait, can I ask you a question? What is the theory behind that? Because I don't know if that's still the rule. I mean, I know people who do that, but I've never asked what happens in the interim. But what was the reasoning behind not auditioning?
I honestly don't remember. I don't know if it was you're not ready or you need the training before you can do the actual work. I honestly don't remember what it was.
My cynical self wants to say that if you audition and you book work, then you won't need them, but that's very cynical.
Well, but
You know what I mean?
who's to say, Amy, that could be part of their thinking. I don't know. I will tell you that the West Coast division of the Academy just closed this year. It's devastating for the
Wow.
people that were there because there's a New York school and a Los Angeles school. And when I started the Los Angeles school, it was fairly new. And so,
Wow. Okay.
yeah, sad.
That's interesting. So you quit, so you stayed a year, like 2 semesters, or like what do I want to say, like 8 or 9 months, whatever, the school year.
The school year.
And did you, so when you started auditioning, were you about 19, 18, 19?
Probably, yeah, 1920. Yeah.
I'm going to ask this because I haven't talked to anybody about this in a long time. How did you find auditioning back then? Like, as not as an adult, as an older person, looking back to what auditioning was like those years ago, what do you see like in retrospect? Because I feel like, okay, digital and all the stuff, notwithstanding, and self-tapes, I mean, it's changed a lot since COVID. But
Yeah.
even before that, actually, let me say this. I was driving down, I can't even think of the name of the street, some street, and I passed Ocean Park where they have the buildings where they do a lot of commercial auditions, like in Santa Monica.
Right.
And so I was thinking back, my son used to audition, and I've probably been in one of those buildings, let's say, in, I don't know, 5, 10 years. And I was sort of thinking about what that was like. But this is like the early 2010s. But you'd go in a room, everybody, I can never figure this out. It was the bizarrest thing. It would be a room full of people who all looked alike. And
Yes.
I was like, wow, people are not as different as you think. Or they, I mean, because it's Southern California. It's not like they're flying them in from some far. But, and people got like a few very short period of time. They were always late. I never figured this out. You got your 14 seconds to do your thing or 14 minutes, depending. And then you were out. But it was very, I want to say, like assembly line. It didn't feel personal.
Yeah, no, it wasn't.
But
And it was so odd walking into a room and seeing a dozen of me. I
is
mean,
it
literally, I'm like, oh my God. And so then you knew when you walked into that room, you knew exactly what they were looking for,
right?
as opposed to you walk into a room and it's everything under the sun and you go, oh, they have no idea what they're looking for. And so it's two very different things because you go, well, either way, you have to hit it. Either way, you have to sound, you have to give them something that they're not hearing. And I will tell you, I don't know if you know, I was the Tide Lady in the late 90s. And I remember that audition so clearly because there were a lot of different women. And I remember doing this audition, and there was copy as opposed to you just walk in and say your name and, given their profiles and who your agent is. And sometimes that's all it was. And you walk
Right.
out.
Yep, the 10, I think it
And
was like 10,
this,
14 seconds. Yeah, it was really long.
right. And this was an actual copy. So I had a couple of pages of copy to read. And I remember doing it. And you go in and you have to basically do it and forget about it when you leave because you have no idea what's going to happen and you can't obsess about it. And I remember my agent called and she said, you got it. And I said, I got what? Because this was my first major, I'd done smaller commercials, but this was my first major national big thing. And she said there was something about the way you said, and I don't even remember what the sentence was, but it was the way I turned a phrase, and it was almost like a Chandler Bing type of thing, the spin I put on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got me the part. And you just never know. You don't know.
No, so. I think about this in books or any sort of thing where you're going to like put out a lot of feelers and have a lot of rejection. You really do walk away and not think about it. And then when you get a call, the call, you're always like, wait, what? And it's so funny because I think people are like, is it not important to you? And you think, oh my God, if I sat home and like worried about everything or every feeler, every query I sent out, I would like, you know, you'd be under the bed with anxiety. Right.
Exactly. And that turned out to be the first of six commercials. I mean, that was just when they were beginning the series, you know, spokesperson type of thing.
So wait, what's the Tide thing? I don't know about this. Tell me about this.
Well, I was the Tide lady for a year and a half. So I did six commercials for Tide.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They flew me to Chicago and Houston. I think I actually went to Chicago twice. And I would walk into a store and shoot in a local store for Tide. It was like Tide for this store out here. I drove to Orange County at 1 a.m. to shoot in an Albertsons, and it was Tide for Albertsons.
Oh.
And so I did it in Target and Kmart and Albertsons and all these smaller markets in the Midwest.
How did you like it? Because most people I know, okay. Let me say this. I don't know people who've done a series. So most people I know who've done a national commercial have done the one thing, whether it's like a burger or a drink or mm-hmm. I don't know. What did she do? Was it? I can't even remember. A lot of people I know have had a national commercial, but it's usually like a one and done. And although I know people live on it like for years, so I'm not saying that.
Oh yeah, sure.
The money, but it's a one and done. So were you able to? Is it a character? I mean, okay. So if you're going to do like a series or something, you know, you create a character, but mm-hmm. was it the same sense for doing commercials after doing more than one?
Yeah. Well, so I thought it was a one and done, and they called back for a second one. And that's when my agent realized this was going to be bigger than she initially thought. Mm-hmm. And so then two became three, became four, became five. And you know, I just was mom. Right. I just, that was the thing. I was just mom. So it.
Wait, how old were you that you're doing the mom?
I was 30.
Okay.
Because I found out I was pregnant right before the second commercial.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yes. So I had to break the news to them, and I thought I was afraid they were going to fire me. So I actually waited until after I shot the second commercial to tell them. So I was in the studio doing voiceovers for the commercial. I did hundreds of voiceovers for all the commercials because they had to list. I listed every store in the country that carried Tide.
Oh my gosh.
So it was,
I mean, that's fine. It's fine, but yes.
Yeah. But it's as massive as it. Yeah. So, I waited till I was in the studio after the second commercial to break the news to them. And they're in the studio in Chicago. So I don't even have a face to face with all of these,
mm-hmm.
all of these people. And, God bless them. They ended up writing it in so that the very last commercial, I was 9 months pregnant and they wrote it into the script, and they were actually thrilled that they could do that.
That's really great because how can I say this? Most people I know, so I'm like 52, I had a child late for different reasons, but most people I know who were actors postponed pregnancy because for everyone I know, it took 2 years off their career. And, you know,
it did. It took 3 years off. I took 3 years off. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because you can't. Well, what I found out when a friend of mine was pregnant, she was like, they don't cast pregnant people as pregnant people. She was like, so she thought that in the period that she was pregnant, she could go out and do like, you know, just guest spots as a pregnant. Yeah. And then she is a pregnant woman. And she was like, I guess I just found out that that's not a thing. And that was super interesting.
Are you a creative looking for a new writing and reading podcast?
check out Dark Side of the Word, a weekly podcast for all the dark story lovers out there. Co-hosts Kate and CJ are two writers and bloggers who love to talk about their creative projects, their thoughts on that trending spooky story, how writing their latest novels is coming along, and much more. Each month's episodes are broken into four categories: writing updates from the trenches, content recaps, current events in the writing and publishing world, and a monthly book club that reads dark-themed books. All topics are dissected and discussed from a writer's perspective. Watch Dark Side of the Word on YouTube or listen to the audio-only version on iHeart, Apple, and Spotify. Did you, after the, let me say this, so you, did the Tide thing give you like the boost of confidence to like keep pushing forward with the hope that things would, with the hope of other things, or were you doing other things simultaneous to that? Because some people I know do, like they only work out and live off the money from a commercial. You know what I mean? And some people are like constantly hustling. I'm not saying one is better than the other.
I was still trying to get work, which there wasn't. It was when I was doing Tide, that was all I was doing. And then after I had her, I continued to do voiceovers for all the commercials that I shot. But then after that last pregnant commercial, they were done with my particular series. So then it was just, well, I have a baby. I'm taking time off because I can't really drag her to auditions. I mean, I guess I could have, but I didn't see anybody else doing it. I just couldn't imagine doing it.
No.
So, yeah.
So let me say this. So where does this fit? Let me go back. Okay. So one of the main reasons I'd want to do the interview is because you have your job is right. The dialogue coach on The Conference. But also that was working on Roseanne was also that sort of the beginning of this, like this,
yes.
this particular career. Where does the beginning of Roseanne fit in with the Tide commercial?
You know, getting my job at Roseanne, for me, it was my way to get my foot in the door for television, because I figure I'm going to meet casting people. I'm going to meet producers. I'm going to meet other actors. You know, and working as her stand-in, which is what I was hired to do, I got to rehearse scenes when, you know, if for some reason she stormed off the set and they were still rehearsing, I got to be Roseanne. I mean, that's, I did scenes with John Goodman and Laurie Metcalf. Come on. I mean, I was in a position, it was a dream. It, for where I was and just starting out, it was a dream job. And I was thrilled with it. So I was still trying to audition around, you know, working on set. I mean, the Tide thing actually happened after, Roseanne. So I was already gone from there.
Okay.
So that I was really back into the whole auditioning thing by the time the Tide thing happened. But, I had done some commercials before that. So like during the hiatus from the show, when I was back to auditioning and doing more actor things, for myself, I had a couple of commercial, you know, smaller regional ones. Doing the show was just a greater, as good an education as it was going to the Academy. Let me put it that way.
That's the thing. A friend and I were just talking about this because she was on set and she was talking about how much younger people can learn just from being on set. Because the span of that particular cast was like 18 to 80.
Right.
And the 80-year-old person's very famous, but it was just super interesting that you can learn so much because there's a lot of downtime. So let's go back. So how did you come to?
My husband's friend, who was an assistant director, stood in on the pilot, but that was not her regular gig. She also had her SAG card, so she was able to do that. So she stood in for Roseanne on the pilot, and then it went to series, and she couldn't do it, and she suggested me, and I interviewed and I got the job. And I had done a tiny bit of stand-in work on my husband's show, which was a little show called Boys Will Be Boys, with an unknown actor named Matthew Perry. Bless his heart. I just, anyway, different story. Yeah. So anyway, I was only there part-time. So this was going to be my first full-time on a set where I had to be there every day. And I literally, and I had been a huge fan of Roseanne. I loved her domestic goddess routine. So I was so thrilled to be there. And I walked on set and looked at the cast list and I see George Clooney and I nearly fall over because I loved him from Facts of Life. So I started there standing in for her. It got very crazy that first 9 episodes about who was in charge. There was a lot of infighting between the director and the executive producers and Roseanne. She had an acting coach there who left after 9 episodes to direct a show on Broadway. And they needed somebody to work with her. And because I was her stand-in and had a relationship with her, they said, hey, will you do it? And I'm young and stupid. And I said, sure. And I start running lines with her. And I'm working as her dialogue coach and her stand-in. And that's how it started. And when we came back for a second season, I said, so can I get paid for doing this job now? And then they started paying me. So, yeah.
Can I ask you, so, I interviewed somebody maybe a couple of years ago who was sort of similarly in the center of, I don't want to call it a storm, like center of when something goes very, very, is very, very popular, okay, very, very quickly. And I don't know if in our human evolution, we sort of have a way to manage that. But what was it like being in the center? Because the show became very popular very quickly. You know, shows have a slow burn and then some of them just like take off and you're just like, well, that went to the stratosphere very quickly. What was it like being in the center of that kind of storm? Because you have like, I'll ask you what it was like. Because you have the actual like onset things, then you have the onset drama, and then you have the external factors.
I just remember literally, I would look around me with my literal open mouth and just not believing everything that was happening. I've never seen people get treated like that before. Where I'm from, you're just respectful to people. And there was not a lot of respect. And it was fascinating to me, and scary for a young 22-year-old. So I just really kept my mouth shut and did my job. I put up with substantial physical abuse from her because I didn't know any better and I didn't want to lose my job. So I put up with a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff.
Do you think that that's
yes, definitely it's changed. You can't do what she did. You can't.
Well, you think so? I wonder about that. I think okay. So there's a famous actor who many people know who films a lot of movies and doesn't always show up. So, and I have a friend who worked on set, and I'm like, did he show up today? And she's not today. You know what I mean? And so there has been, but the movies make a lot of money. So there have been big allowances for all sorts of behavior on set. And I feel like, no, let me say this. I have this sort of hope that in the last, I don't even know now, 10 years, there's been a sort of reckoning that we can't just be out here and be crazy on set. And then all these documentaries that have come out with like, whether it's kids shows or, I mean, lots of set craziness, and abuse and things that just really, you're just like, really? And then you're also like, yes, because if the shows make money, the producer, actor, director, whoever the out of control person is, it's like they're rocking a boat and everybody's running around steadying the boat rather than pushing them out of the boat and replacing them. And I know people always say that they're not replaceable.
Well, that was back in the day where If you said there was a problem, then you became the problem and you disappeared. And I couldn't have kept my job, and I was making a very, very good salary. And you got to keep in mind, when you're on a sitcom, you work 24 weeks. I mean, that was then, and now it's not even that. 24 weeks was all I got. And if you missed a day for some reason, you didn't get paid. There was no PTO, and there still isn't. And I,
It's sort of the original gig
yeah.
economy in many ways. I mean, with some union protections, but you know what I mean? You're
And
paid
so
or you're not
when
working.
you think about you only know you're working 24 weeks out of the year, your mentality is, well, I can't lose that, you know, because then what am I going to do? I'm already hustling half the year. You know, what if I can't find something? So it's all of those fears. But I mean, she literally broke my eardrum. She smacked me in the head over my ear so hard, she popped my eardrum. And that was just one of several things that she physically did. And I stayed because that was my job. That's what I did. I did not know any better.
But you didn't stay. Did you stay for
Nope.
the
I was
duration of
only
the
there for the
show or
first four
no?
seasons. Tom Arnold fired me to give my job to Miss Iowa. They had done a movie of the week over the hiatus, and Miss Iowa was part of the production in Iowa, and his assistant had a crush on her. And so they kept thinking, well, how could they bring her back to LA so that she could be close, so that he could be close to her? And they gave her my job. She had never done my job. She did not know what my job entailed. And I literally got fired 2 weeks before the fifth season. Well, 2 weeks before I thought I was going to have a show, everything else in town is screwed up. There was nothing for me to go to. So I called every contact in town that I knew, including all the people who had been fired from the show beforehand, which was a lot of people.
What?
And I worked. I stood in, I filled in on a half a dozen different shows. I did fine. I did fine that season. And then the next season I managed to go back to my dialogue coach work on a Chuck Lorre show. It was probably his only show that didn't go for 12 years. It was
What
called
show was
Franny's
that?
Turn
Actually,
with no, it was
Grand
called
Dresser?
Franny's Turn with Miriam
No.
Margolyes. It was kind of like an I Love Lucy.
I literally have never heard of this, and I feel like I've seen
It it
every
we yep,
one-off,
we were one, we
some
were
of which
one
I
and one
love.
season, one and done. And she was English, but she was playing, I don't know if, I don't remember if we were Chicago or New York. And I forget the name, the guy who played her husband, he was Latin. And so it was kind of like a Lucy Desi type of thing.
Oh, it really was. I mean, really. Wait, where's this shot? Was it like Warner Brothers or Paramount? Where was this? I feel like Fox. I feel like
No,
a Fox lot,
I
basically.
wasn't at Fox. I don't remember where we were. Maybe we were at Radford Studios.
Oh,
I
okay.
honestly
Oh,
don't
yeah,
remember.
Studios.
I've
Yeah,
done
the Studio
so
City.
many. I honestly don't remember where we did that. It might have been Warner Brothers. I don't remember. I would have to, maybe if I IMDb'd it, I would remember, but
Yeah, I know. Oh, that's so. Well, okay. Then I'm piece this together. So when between, let me say this, between Franny's Turn, which I'm gonna look up because I literally never heard of it, between Franny's Turn and the kids shows, did those come immediately after
Immediately
that?
after.
No, not immediately after, but
Yeah, all
in
of that came after. So
after, I
yeah,
guess.
so I did Franny's Turn. I did a show called Still Standing for 4 seasons.
I remember
And so there were
that.
a lot of short things in the middle, you know, after Franny's Turn. I did a lot of pilots, a lot of things that were six and out or nine and out. And then I finally did Still Standing for 4 seasons. And then after that,
Well,
Can I ask what still, because still stand, I remember that. Okay. I think it was a Friday night show. What, did you then have a comparative view of one set versus another? Like, was it, did you then think to yourself, okay, on-set life can be different, can be calmer, relatively calmer, or more collaborative, or more ensemble-based?
Oh, yeah, the more work I did after Roseanne, the more I realized, oh, that was insane. That
was the anomaly.
Exactly,
yeah.
That was the anomaly. That doesn't happen. That was whacked out, crazy pants stuff. Oh, there are normal people here. They're just doing the work.
It's something we talk about, like, in general, because if your first experience at, I know, some crazy school job, whatever, is the crazy banana pants one, it warps expectations. It takes a while to smooth it out in the sense of, oh, it's not always like that. And it's a big world out here, and it's not always like that. But it's that sort of primacy, that first experience imprints
pretty
deeply.
It definitely does, but it was so nice to know that that was the crazy and that it wasn't normal. And so then I'm working on show after show after show, and every show has their, you know, idiosyncrasies. Every actor, every person, not just an actor, every person has their own quirks. And every job is different, and you're dealing with different personalities, but at least, you know, you kind of knew what you were going to get. Whereas with Roseanne, you walked in every day and didn't know what you were going to get. And so it was eggshells. Yeah. It was eggshells.
No, that's mentally, it's mentally very hard, because your brain can't make sense of, okay, the anticipation of something happening,
right,
but not knowing what it is.
It's
is often
draining.
Very difficult.
It is so draining. I mean, even when we came back for the reboot with Roseanne, I wasn't sure what to expect. Now, I had done a pilot with Roseanne and John in 2012. So I had worked with her, and it was fine. So that when I came back for the reboot, I thought, oh, everything's going to be great. And we had a very rough start. She wasn't particularly kind, and we had words. And after we had a little heart to heart, which was kind of in front of about 125 people, she got better.
So wait, I have to ask you, what made you go back? I mean, because this is the thing I always call it for you. I always think about this as your full circle, because that's like your first, I don't want to say big job, but first, I don't know, significant sort of work. And you're working on the Conners now. So you went back, but before it was the Conners, Roseanne was on it for not long. What made you
to
go
the
back?
Original reboot of Roseanne?
Yes.
Well, because like I said, I'd worked with her in 2012 and she was fine. We had a good, a good relationship, so that when the show came back, I wanted, you know, I'm looking for work. So I figure I have.
Right. I mean, we all
exactly.
Like to eat.
So I'm looking for a job and I figure I have a better shot than most because I have a relationship with her. And I did.
Right.
But literally when I came in and I hadn't seen her in, I don't know what it was, 5 or 6 years. And the first thing she says to me, it was in 2012 actually when I hadn't seen her. And she said, oh my God, you're old. And I said to her, I'm not allowed to say the F word, but I said, F you, I look great. So that was literally our beginning. And that was 2012. So that we had a good thing. So that when the reboot came, I was happy to try to get a spot on the show. And literally they hired me for only the camera days. It wasn't enough. And I was trying to tell the producer it's not enough. And she said, well, that's all that's in the budget. So that when I... Yeah,
that's
so when I started
budget,
on the camera days,
funny.
Roseanne was like, you know, where you been? And I'm like, I'm not getting paid. So then she said, well, you got to be here more. So then the next week I was there for 3 days and I get in on, you know, the day before camera days, where you been? I said, well, I'm only getting paid for 3 days. Oh, no. So she made it so that I was there every day after that. She wanted me around.
How long did she... I feel like so much time has passed. How long did she last on the reboot? I remember them changing the name.
So I think the reboot we started, we had 9. And then they gave us an extra episode. So I think we did 10. And then she imploded everything over the hiatus on social
On
media
social media, yeah. I was like,
and blew up her
yeah.
life. And, she, look, I believe in America you have free speech, absolutely. But people don't realize that there are consequences to your speech.
I think that's the hardest part. Like, I keep, and this is something I discuss like with people who are in comedy, and they're like, well, comedy is a job that's a little different than many other jobs where you can say and do more. I guess you have ultimate freedom, because in many cases they're self-employed. But people, I think, are always surprised at the consequences. And I was like, you literally have the right to say everything. You
Absolutely.
can say whatever you want, but that doesn't mean that everybody's going to fall behind you and
Right.
go rah rah. And I think people, it seems to me, people are always
People
surprised
are
at the
surprised at the
consequences.
consequences, which surprises me. Because when you say vile things about somebody, well, you're allowed to do that, but everybody else is allowed to take offense. And so you got to be prepared. And that's the thing about social media is it's like this blind void where you're not in somebody's face and you say something and it's like, oh, yeah, I can say whatever I want. But people react and have feelings toward these words that you have thrown out into the universe. And
Yes, because I was just listening to an interview of Kathy
yes.
Griffin talk about a similar thing. And I was thinking, I don't know, I have a lot of thoughts on social media, but my sense is, well, no, it's so hard. Like, let me say this. So, we're obviously in an election cycle. And so I do talk to my son about this, and he's like, is this normal? I'm like, I don't know. In the 80s, you could not have done all this. But I feel like the fact that sets were more closed, there wasn't social media, people could get away with more in the way we were just talking about, but there was no, you could say it into a room of 50 people, 100 people, or whatever. And except for like people whispering around in LA, I don't think it got that far. And so there was somewhat more freedom without consequences. I think social media has given people, well, more
I
freedom and more
definitely, I agree.
consequences.
I agree. Yeah.
Were you worried about the not, how can I say this? Not many shows, not many. I'm trying to think. There's actually a few. Have changed stars, not so much the name, but have changed, stars like,
Right,
Darren's a new
right.
Darren or
Yeah.
whatever it is, and have survived. Were you worried about them? Because I think the switch to the Conners was unexpected because, at least, well, maybe not for you. Most people I know just assume the show would end.
Right. And
You know what I
we,
mean? Like, it would be
well,
like, well,
it
we
basically,
tried that and
yeah, I
it's
mean,
imploded and
basically,
bye.
we did end. I mean, we got canceled. And Sarah Gilbert, God bless her heart, my boss, I love her with all my heart. She saved the show. She's the one that said, hey, what if we do this? We give it a different name. We keep everybody, but we just give it a different name and continue with these characters that are so loved. And luckily ABC went for it. Roseanne had to make a deal. I have no idea what the deal is or was, but I know we
Right,
came back
right.
because Sarah Gilbert fought for us. So yeah, that's the only reason we're there because we were canceled. We were done.
What, so how, then I guess I'll ask you this. So then how has it been working on the Conners? Because that's a different animal. Is it a, have you really, have you then like moved into the space where you can, how can I say this
Oh
kindly,
my God,
enjoy
I
your
love
work?
my job. I love my job. I love the people I work with. It is truly a family. I mean, I know people have work families, but this is truly a work family. I mean, Sarah and Lisi were 13 years old when I first worked with them and knew them. And I stood in for both of them in the beginning. I stood in for Lisi and she outgrew me. So then I stood in for Sarah. And then I was still dialogue coaching. And now they're, yeah, I mean,
Adult women, yes.
they're in their late 40s, 50. And it's like, It's crazy because you don't ever get that opportunity. And we're historical that way in what we've done, bringing back the same core group of actors, two different incarnations of the show with 100+ episodes. I mean, that doesn't happen.
No, I mean,
And
no. I mean, there's a lot of studios that wish it would, but
these
no.
actors are amazing. And I get to go play with them every day. And it's just an absolute highlight. The fact that we're ending in a couple of weeks is just heartbreaking for me. I'm gonna miss these people.
It's hard. And I'll ask you, do you think you'll feel adrift?
Probably, sure.
So let's go back. So the way I met you is through, well, Los Angeles Romance Authors, which still exists. I'm sorry, RWA. Most of the many, I actually just looked online. Most of the local chapters are have disaffiliated. So, but Lara, I believe, still is. So we met there. I feel like when my son was pregnant, when I was pregnant, my son was pregnant, he wasn't pregnant. So maybe 2009, eight, maybe. I don't know. I joined before, and then I got pregnant, and then I had a hiatus, and then I came back after I published a book. Okay, so I met you as a published author, and we've been talking about this separate whole dialogue, you know, ABC multiple like commercial sitcom life. How did
Start writing.
you? Correct. Because it's different. I mean, I don't know, maybe like photography and painting or something are both visual, or you know what I mean? Or dancing and I don't know,
It was,
whatever. Choreography is similar, but these are like, not, I'm gonna say diametrically opposed, but maybe
well,
diametrically
yeah,
opposed.
I mean, there, I had never considered writing. I'm dyslexic. It never was a thing for me. It was completely accidental. I wiped out on the tennis court, blew out all the ligaments in my ankle on a gorgeous backhand, and I was laid up. And I had a dream, and I was talking about the dream to my husband the next day, and I was going on and on and on. And he's like, "Well, why don't you just write it down?" And those were very prophetic words. I started writing. And literally 14 hours a day, every day for like 6 weeks, I wrote. And I ended up with 450 longhand pages later, and I had a book. And I just started where the dream started and ended. And then I had to start from the beginning and make up this whole beginning. It's like, well, how do I get to this place where the dream started? Which is kind of the climax of the whole book. And
Oh,
so
that's so
then I
funny.
started at the beginning. And, I will tell you, well, then I went to the LA Festival of Books and discovered the Romance Writers of America and at the
Oh,
booth. Yep.
the
Yep.
booth.
And I ended up going to the Los Angeles meetings.
What
Oh
year?
my gosh, this had to be in 2001, maybe.
Oh, okay. I just moved to LA.
And,
Okay.
I went to the first meeting and I learned so much. And I went home and I rewrote the book. And the next month, I went to another meeting and I learned so much. And I went home and I rewrote the book. After the sixth meeting, I didn't want to go back because I was in tears because I had rewritten my book every month because I learned something new. And I
Oh,
was
that's
afraid to go because
fascinating. Yeah.
I was afraid to have to rewrite it again. So, but it was so informative. And, you know, that first book is under the bed, as were the next two. But it was finally the fifth book was the one that actually sold first, but then I managed to sell the fourth and fifth books. So, because they were a one and a two, but the number two actually sold first. But then I said, "Hey, do you want the first one?" So,
Yeah, I think we talked about this because I had a similar experience. It's like, hey, you bought number two. Hey, look what
Look at
I
number
got.
one.
And publishers don't mind it per se, because they can get, I want to say two for the price of one, because that's probably what I offered. But they
Well, then
can,
they know there's
how can
something
they say
there.
this?
They
They
know
can,
that there's substance there,
yes,
and
correct.
they can maybe get
Yeah.
more, which they did.
Yes. Oh, yes, then, yeah. What, So these are with
Yes.
Karina,
Yeah.
which at the time, and I don't know now, at the time was, oh my God, was it Harlequin's first
Digital, yes.
ebook, first
Yeah.
imprint? Yeah, digital
Yes.
first imprint. Yeah.
And they had,
Oh my God, with Angela
yes.
James, right? Oh God, sorry. I just hadn't thought
Yep.
about her in a very long time. Yes. And so it was a huge departure from Harlequin, which, as you know, and many listeners know, published many, many, many print books and many, many lines monthly. So, I mean, they had a pipeline that, was constantly working. And the digital first was, they were not the first digital first, but it was the first large publisher that, had that
I think so.
infrastructure to go
I think
digital
so.
first. And what was that experience? Wait, who was your editor? Was Angela and James your editor, or was she just acquiring back then? I'm trying to
Angela was not
remember.
my editor. My editor was Melissa Johnson, who I adore, and I stuck with her when I left Carina Press. I actually kept my same team when I left Carina Press, because Carina, after four books, wanted me to do a different series, and I wasn't done with this series. I still had characters that had stories screaming in my head, so I just decided to do those on my own. But I managed to keep the same team. But
I think that's so interesting because I found that, even, and I was talking to somebody recently, many editors I know also freelance. Well, now they freelance because a lot of people got laid
yes.
off. I mean, we can discuss like private equity and the mergers and all that, but a
Yeah.
lot of editors, graphic artists, many people, copy,
Yeah.
line, many kind of editors got laid off. So it's easy. You can assemble a similar team. And I know people who have published with Amazon who had a team brought from the Amazon and took the team when the Amazon didn't work out. So I do think that that's for all the issues in publishing and the digital first and payments and
Right.
percentages, being able to keep the same team is such a new phenomenon because when you left publishers before, you left all those
Right,
people
exactly.
behind. And you had to cross your fingers and hope that the next group that you encountered could give you the same or better,
Right. Well,
hopefully, than what you are
I
getting.
got the feeling that, the big time publishers, I don't think that they cared about their people because they care about their bottom line, unfortunately. And so if they're not doing well, if books aren't selling as well, they're going to take it out on their staff and get rid of their staff. And I think m multiple publishing houses, slice their staff. And
So, yes, so much, especially in the last 10 years. So a lot of the people that used to come to the conferences that we went to in the, let's say, the 2000s, are all freelance now. It's something else. So what was it like? Okay, getting that first call, what was that like? Because you're doing this, I mean, so you have it's not as if this is the only artistic success you've had. So you're already successful in one arena, and then you get the call, and then you're able to publish in a completely different sort of artistic medium.
Yes, I mean, I had been trying for 10 years. Keep in mind, I had been trying writing and trying to sell for 10 years. So that when I got the call, I know exactly when it was. It was December 29th because it was my sister's birthday. And I was working on a Nickelodeon show because I got to go into work and tell everybody, because everybody knew I was a writer, because I would work all day on set and go home and write for 4 or 5 hours in front of the computer every night. And I would write at lunch every day. I would pull out my notebook and handwrite at lunch almost every day. So everybody knew. It was a sob fest. I was thrilled. I finally sold a book, and it happened to be two books. It was amazing. Yeah. I mean, I'll just never forget standing at the window talking to my agent, and she's telling me, well, they want your book. And I'm like, what? That was just like when my agent called for the Tide commercial. What? Did I just hear you right? What? Yeah.
No, so let me ask you this. What have you learned about rejection? Because the things that you're talking about two industries where the
Tell me
rejection
about
is way higher than the
Tell me
acceptance.
about it.
And so you go from one industry with, I mean, acting, we can't even discuss the rejection in the
Oh,
entertainment
yeah.
industry. It's just, it's
Yes.
legion. I mean, the number of like cast aside, like actors, screenwriters, like it's just, it's everybody like littering the streets of LA.
Oh, yeah. No, I
But
literally
you went
jumped
from
from one fire into another fire.
to
And
the, and yeah, but what, so I feel like your need and that need, desire to tell a story is greater than the fear of rejection.
I guess that's what it comes down to. You have these voices in your head. I mean, I have a book in my head ready to go from start to finish. And I just have not, I figure when I retire from showbiz is when I'll get this next book out. But it's there from, and every night before I go to bed, these characters go through the story at any given point, and it's in my head. And that's what it was for all these books. And it didn't used to be like that. I mean, I didn't, before I started writing, I used to like make up stories just in my head to go to sleep, as opposed to somebody reading me a bedtime story. I used to read myself my own made up bedtime story, but it was never anything that was the same story that was in my head that didn't leave my head until I wrote it down. That started happening once I actually started writing books. But now, until I put these people on a page, they're going to be in my head.
I know that's the compulsion, and I did the same thing as you. So when I was a kid, I would make up stories because reading, I couldn't always have the light on because then I get in trouble. So I would make up stories, and there was nothing that sort of stuck. But once I write, I was telling you before we started recording that I am in the middle of this sort of compulsion issue, and it's just. I wish there were, well, no, I'm sorry. I was going to say, I wish there were a way to get them out of your head, but the way to get them out of your head is writing. But it's really like right now I go to sleep and I wake up and this is all I think about. Like it's literally all I think about. I mean, I'm driving the car and I'm thinking about it and I'm cooking the dinner and I'm thinking about it. And so how do you, so are you able then to, because I write full time, so I don't know. Are you able to set aside the characters in your head in order to go to work and then, help people tell these
Oh,
other
sure.
stories.
Yeah, it doesn't come into my head until I lay down, my day is done, and then they pop up into my head going, "Well, we're here and we're going to keep you up for the next 2 hours thinking about this story."
Oh, okay. So your head's like, as soon as I relax, they're
Yes.
gonna bring in these others. Okay. Do you think that if with the end of the Conners that you'll then write, or do you plan to hustle your way right into the next job? Although I guess what month is it?
This,
Yeah, because then
that would be lovely to hustle my way into a next job. I have no idea where that it would be. Unfortunately, the town
Well,
is
but
kind of dead right now, and
that's what
sitcoms are very cyclical. I mean, television is very cyclical. It's like, is it
so much.
reality or is it 1 hour dramatic? Is it, plus all the streamers and, now they're only doing 10 episodes or six episodes, special limited series. And it's like, well, that isn't really enough to pay the rent. So
No, that's limited
yeah,
employment is what
this
it is.
town has changed so much in the years that I've been here that it's scary. It's a scary place.
I'll ask you this because I know, let me say this, most of the people I know are working. But that's because they have the ability to call the shots. So if you're a showrunner or whatever, or you have a deal or overall deal or whatever, they're still there. I'm not saying this is going to last forever, but we're all just trying to like game it out until retirement, to be frank. Given the age, I'm not 22, so it's different. But what do you feel that they? Well, I don't know if it's COVID or the strikes and these, we're back to back to back. Changed the industry, or did you think the downturn was going to come with the streamers and everything else before?
Streamers definitely changed television. The internet.
But in the beginning, it was like it looked like a bonanza. It was like, I mean, I had, how can I say, I have a lot of, so okay, I'm 52, so I have a lot of friends who are older women. And before streaming, like maybe like about 15 years ago, not before streaming, but about 15 years ago, a lot of my friends we were talking about, because they were getting up there in age, you know, mid late 30s. And they're like, this is women, every job I do is I'm crying over some man, whether he's dead, in jail, you know, abusing me or whatever, or I'm giving birth. And I thought it was such an interesting way to look at it. So with streaming, a lot of women I know got substantial jobs because there were a lot of shows back in the beginning. And then, so it felt like a bonanza. And then now it feels like we just like swung the pendulum all the way in the other
Well,
direction.
it's weird because, you know, streaming came along and it was a new deal. It was a new way to work.
Although the money was different, so that's its own
Yeah,
problem for
money
sure.
was different and it wasn't regulated. They were doing things that the unions didn't have a playbook for.
I know the new media and
Yes. So now if you notice, the streamers are starting, they're saying, well, we're losing money. And so guess what? We're going to have to start, we're paying for it and we're going to start seeing ads because they
Oh God,
can't
yes.
keep that model going like they anticipated. So it's going to go back to what the networks offer anyway, except, oh, now we're paying for it.
Can I just tell you, like, this is, I mean, to be off topic, I just, like, I was sitting down because I had to pay bills, you know, and I'm sitting down and I'm thinking, like, I just canceled one streamer because I'm just over it. But I'm like, so I got rid of cable in the 90s because I could not believe the amount monthly people wanted me to pay to sit through so many commercials. And I was like, in the streamers, so now each one is basically like $20 a month if you don't want commercials. And I was like, how is it that we're back to the same thing where I'm going to end up paying 60, 80, whatever, $100 a month for all these services? And then they want me to watch commercials. And I understand that the economics of it. And I always wonder, like, was it thought out? Because what I've read is that even if they were able to grow subscriptions infinitely, it would never pay as much as commercials do. And that's why commercials are inevitable.
I just, you know, they're making a lot of money and apparently it's not enough money. So
Yeah, I know it's never enough. That's a different.
it's a whole scary, the dollar is a scary thing. And so yeah, it's like I said, it's a model that I think they thought they could keep going, and the reality is different. If you're talking about their bottom line and making money, their reality is different. And so,
Not the true nature of like what could occur if everybody took a reasonable income or something. I mean, that's a
and
different
add
reason
to the
that.
fact that the younger generation is watching YouTube, and they're on TikTok, and they're on whatever, you know, social media app, and that has just
So many eyeballs.
Siphoned eyeballs away from television. And so it's a completely different animal now.
So I want to go back. So in addition to doing like sitcoms, well, I want to say this like what I consider like, you know, regular sitcoms, you also did work on kid shows. Is that I'm sorry. I've watched some of them because they came to be after long after I was a kid. So I did not have the same tolerance for laugh tracks or any of that that I had as a, you know, as a child watching whatever sitcoms on TV. How was that different? Like working, how was working with kids? The time issues notwithstanding, if they're under 18, how is that different than working with adults? Mostly adults. I mean, sitcoms are not all adults and there's a lot of kids, but it's they're more adults. I feel like it's a lot Charlie Brown, like, you know, wah, wah,
You
wah with
know,
adults.
kids, I didn't find a huge difference. Kids are so sharp. 95% of the kids that I've worked with are so sharp. And their minds are younger. They're just younger actors. They're just littler. But they're sharp and they're quick at learning lines. And the thing I love about kids is that they bring their own take to the words on the page that is not something you would maybe generally hear in your head when you read the sentence for the first time. And then you hear a kid say it, and it's either, you know, hysterical or touching or whatever it is, but kids just bring something fresh and different to the material. And so for me, it was never a big difference. It was just, again, every actor is a different personality. So working right. with somebody who's 7 years old versus somebody who's 37 years old, everybody has different strengths and weaknesses. And as you work with people, you find out what those are, and that's how you help, you know, mold them or help them find a character or find a joke or put the emphasis where it needs to be to understand a joke. So there wasn't a huge difference for me.
Okay, but then in my head, children are sort of diametrically opposed from adults. So children are either open to like learning anything or doing anything, or they end up saying the same thing in a certain way and they're kind of set, and then that feels difficult to change. Whereas adults, either I've been doing this forever and I have my methods, or they're more open in the sense of I've seen it all and let's try anything, because getting the joke, getting the audience laugh, whatever, is more important than my ego.
Right. So then again, it depends on each personality, because mm-hmm. There are some actors who are like, this is how I'm doing it. And, with Roseanne, sometimes I would have to explain the joke so that she understand where the emphasis is. Mm-hmm. Trust me, explaining a joke to Roseanne when you've got 100 people watching is
no mean feat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But like I said, every actor is different. Most are open to, you know, interpretation. I call myself a script interpreter. I look at the punctuation in a script, and that tells me what the writer is going for. And being a writer helped me, you know, be an interpreter. Because from a writing standpoint, I feel like I know what they're looking for. So I'm always an advocate for the writer and executive producer, because mm-hmm. I know, you know,
it wasn't just random.
Yeah. I understand why this is a period and not a question mark. This is a statement here. You're not making this a question mark, and it will change the connotation of this whole paragraph. And so to tell that to an actor, it's like, oh, then you get a different reading, and oh, maybe that's the one the writers really wanted. Okay. So as the script interpreter, as a dialogue coach, this is how these words were meant to be delivered. So that's what I do. And age really, because I can explain myself the same way to an older actor as I can to a younger actor. I might be a little more simple depending on the age of a younger actor. I mean, if somebody's 4 years old, you know, I'm going to deliver it a different way. It's like, so you said what? You know, it's going to be a little different, but you know, they're also in general not going to have as much material if they're 4 years old.
Yes. There's a lot of limitations right there. Yeah. So one of the things that is interesting to me is, let's say this, another little side project you did was they overheard on the mm-hmm. set book.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration for that? I always assumed it was the kids, but when looking at the book recently, like before this interview, as opposed to back when it was published, mm-hmm. It included as many adult things as kid thing. But in my head, from when it was first published, I always thought it was influenced by kids, or maybe it's because the stories you told about the kids were more dramatic. It's hard to say. Like, I'm trying to think, but what was the inspiration for it?
You know, my husband and I have been on so many sets over so many years and heard the most ridiculous things that we thought we should write a book. We should just compile all the stuff we hear. And so that's what we did. It was like every day one of us would come home and say, you're not going to believe what so-and-so said. And you know, when we chuckle about it, like if we're laughing, imagine mm-hmm. what, you know, the average person reading this how they would take it. So we started compiling. And I mean, the ones that didn't make the book, you know, or that's a book in itself. But I mean, literally things directors say to actors or have to say to actors, things that actors have said because of whatever situation or whatever a director said. You know, writers that come down and throw stuff out while we're, you know, in between a take, or instead of a joke, they're rewriting a joke. And it just all made us laugh. And so we thought, well, we had to write a book. So then Overheard on the Set was born. And
Yeah, yeah, it's funny. So did you, I can't, I have no words for it because it is such a unique environment where people are more free with their words than they would be in the average workplace for the most part.
yeah.
And then it yields chaos, craziness, interesting things. Let's
Well,
just
it
say that.
does. Well, and especially, I mean, it came out when we were working in our kids show era. And so when you're working on these kids shows that go over the top with special effects and slime or, you know, all the stunts we do. I mean, we literally shoot a movie worth of stunts in 2 days when we're on camera. And it's insane, and people have no idea. So yeah, with everything that went into producing, you know, just a week's episode and the direction that it took, it's like, I mean, I don't have the book in front of me, but just ridiculous things that a director has to yell out or that they're joking about because of something that happened. It's stuff that you're just not going to hear on the street.
That's for sure.
You
That's
know,
for sure.
you're not going
Yeah,
to hear
so
this in everyday conversation.
one of the other things that you do is voiceover work. What was the impetus to that? So let me say this. Okay, how can I say this? Well, no, I'll just ask you what started you down that path? Because these are many paths,
I
and some people
know.
are only on one path. You
I
know this, right?
know. Yeah. So my first book with Karina was made into an Audible book, and I was never told until it was finished and out. And I was a little heartbroken that I didn't get an opportunity to say, "Hey, I would like to, you know, read my own book. I think I can do it." And I listened to the book, and I was really kind of heartbroken because she didn't read it the way I would have read it. And so, you know, I'm sure she did the best job she could do.
With the information she had.
And I listened to it, and when I found out the next book was going to Audible, and I called Karina and I said, "I would like to read this myself." And they said, "Oh, well, we have nothing to do with it. You have to call Audible." And I don't think they thought I was actually going to call Audible. And of course I did. And,
Right.
and
Sometimes people underestimate women, I think.
I think
They're
so.
like,
I think so.
call the next person. It's like, okay,
Yeah.
I know. You call the next person. It's like, you said call.
Yeah. They thought they were, I'm sure they thought they were getting rid of me. And I call Audible and I work my way through to find the right person. And, you know, I was told I was going to have to audition. I said, "Fine, you know, can't do it right now. He's in a meeting," whoever I had to audition with. And literally at 7 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings. That's 10 o'clock New York time.
Right.
Woke me up out of a sound sleep. And I seen, you know, Audible on on the caller ID. And my voice is scratchy and morning voice. And I'm down like the, you know, B. Arthur, I'm talking like this. And so he says, "Well, can you read the first paragraph of the book?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." And I running, I grab the book, I open it up and I start reading. And after I get like four sentences in, he says, "Oh yeah, you can do it. You can narrate your own book." I'm like, "Thank you." So that's how it started. So I did the second, third, and fourth books. And then I did two of a friend's book. So yeah, I've got four audiobooks. And that was a whole, I mean, I had never narrated a book before, but being an actor, I didn't have any doubt that I could do it. But yeah,
But
it
you know
was.
what the voice is, because as an actor, okay, let's take out the odd, weird, wackadoodle movie or any of those like shows or anything like that. For the most part, you're just one character, so you can spend all your time embodying,
Yes.
working on speaking, and all the other things for one character. But a book is, well, most books are many characters, and
Yes.
that's
Yeah,
it's a crap ton of work.
it was a crap ton of work. You are not kidding. And the prep I did to make sure that I could do it correctly was massive. And you get paid for the finished hour of the book.
Right,
You
per
don't
finished
you don't
hour,
get
yeah.
paid. I mean, I was in the studio for 4 or 5 days for each book, and you don't get paid for 4 or 5 days. You get paid for the finished hour. But that's not even including the prep work before, because you've got to find the voices. You have to know who everybody is in your head. You have to mark those voices. You've got to know what you're reading, so you've got to be a little bit familiar with the storyline so that you can, read it.
Deliver convincingly, yeah.
Exactly. That's the exact phrase, deliver it convincingly. So yeah, it's a crap ton of work, but I was thrilled that I was able to narrate the books that I did. But I know my friend's book, I was like, oh yeah, I'd love to narrate it. And it was through Audible again. And I'm reading the book, and I was her critique partner, so I knew the book. But as I'm like doing my prep work for the audio, I'm like, oh shit, there's 55 characters here. Holy shit, I don't think I have 55 characters in my books co combined. And there's 55 in one book. And I just remember thinking, okay, I could do it. I could do this. I could do this. I could totally psyching myself up for it.
Would you so and so I guess so we're coming to the end of our hour. The thing that I wanted to ask you, so you oh, I hate TV because I with Hulu I can't tell you when I saw it. I know that you did a walk on the Conners, I want to say last spring.
Yeah, it was last season. It was the end of last season, so yeah, last spring.
Okay, and I saw that. What was it like? Because I feel like you've come full circle. Like with all the things that you do, what was it like? Well, A, acting on set, but on the show where you've worked for years. So it's a different, it's not like you're not walking on week 42 and you're there for your 3 days or 2 days or 4 days, depending on your character. So you have a different sort of relationship doing guest starring work than the person who just walks in.
It was wonderful, and just I had a great week. It was really a blur. It all happened so fast. You rehearse it twice and you do a run through one day. You rehearse it twice, you do a run through the next day, and then you're on camera the next day and you're shooting that sucker. And it was wonderful and amazing. And I had the cast sign a script for me. And John Goodman, who I adore, writes, "Welcome aboard." And this is a man I've known since 1989. And for him to, I mean, and I always, I already felt like family, but to have him say that was just like, priceless. Because it was like, now I'm family in a different way. Now I'm like, it was just that extra level of, I don't know, love. But I had a great time. It was really a blur. It happened so fast. I couldn't tell you what I did, Amy,
Wait, have you
honestly.
watched it since? Because it's streaming, you can stream it on Hulu, which I'm
Yeah,
still paying for.
I watched it. I watched it when it aired. I mean, I just watched it the one time.
Okay, I haven't watched it. Yeah.
It's not like I'm replaying it,
No, but I just, some people don't watch their work, and that's
yes.
fair. Like, I get it. Like, that's
Yes.
fair because it seems a little creepy, no
I
offense.
think most of our cast actually doesn't watch their work, which I find amusing. But yeah, I watched it once. I don't remember any of it.
Okay, so given all of these, how can you say all these many talents that you hold, and also that we're not going to live forever, what do you see as the next chapter for you? Like, what would you like to focus on, emphasize, do?
Well, now that's a really good question. I just want to keep busy. I love my set job. I would love to find another show and be on set and just add my little contribution to whatever, is put out in the universe. Like I said, I have another book I know that I'm going to put down one of these days when I get my butt in the chair. If I got another acting gig along the way, I don't know that that's going to happen. I don't have an agent, so the chances of that are slim and none, but I'm never going to count anything out because, you meet so many people in this town, one day the phone could ring,
I know the phone. That's the thing about the phone.
That's the thing. The phone could ring. It's happened before. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I got to see what life throws my way, because so far it keeps throwing, and I keep catching and dodging and weaving. So, you know, we'll see. I don't know what's next. So life will tell me when it tells me, I guess. I'm finally at the point where I don't worry about it as much, I guess.
I think the older you get, the less you can worry. I don't know. I don't know if we could all live with that anxiety for like 30, 40 years. It's just a lot.
Well, that's the thing, is after 40 years of anxiety, I'm kind of done with it. So I don't want it anymore. So I'm just gonna, you know, start the day with my morning walk and let the pieces fall where they may after that.
So DJ Adams, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Well, thank you for having
me. Your experiences are myriad and very different than most writers I know. All so right. Thank you so much for taking the time. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. You too.
This has been A Time to Thrill with me, your host, author Amy Austin. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you share, rate, and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. It will help others find and enjoy my conversations with brilliant women creators. Also, please hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. In addition to hosting this podcast, I'm the author of the Nicole Long series of legal thrillers. The first 4 books in the Nicole Long series are now live. You can download Outcry Witness, Major Crimes, Without Consent, and The Murders Began to your e-reader right now. I'm also the author of the Casey Court series of legal thrillers. These titles are available wherever books are sold, your local library, and also an audiobook. My next book, His Last Mistress, is available for pre-order wherever you get your books. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Legal Thriller Author. You can find me on TikTok at Social Thriller Author. You can also find this podcast on Facebook at A Time to Thrill. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you soon with more great conversations.